on a sunny day at Greenbelt. What more could we ask, right? I have invited, I wanted people to know that we are very welcoming and affirming to all circus performers. So if you would like to juggle or stilt or unicycle or anything, you're welcome to do that at any point. I got to tell you, I have a secret love for the circus. And before I really got active in the church, I was going to run off with the circus. And then I've, you know, found out, right, that there wasn't much difference. It's a sort of circus with our own. The church has its own clowns and fools and hopefully its own daredevils, too. But I think what I love about the circus is that it's got that element of surprise and intrigue. And, you know, the traditional circuses sort of have that element of, like, person and beast being able to play together, that sort of eschatological sign and that faith that when you jump from the trapeze, someone's going to catch you. And there's just so much there, you know? And I think the circus is also one of those things that sort of laughs in the face of death, because I went to circus school and it scared me to death because I learned how to do pyrotechnics. Anyone that taught me pyrotechnics, I have no idea what they were thinking, but I learned to like walk on a tight wire and all those things. And part of what it did was everybody stands and they're, you know, they're kind of in awe, and then love wins, life wins, and it's beautiful, and everybody kind of gives this big ovation. And there's that sense that you can snicker at death. And so I like that. And I think a part of what we've lost in the church is that weird awe, where everybody is celebrated in their goofiness and in their weirdness, and there's a place for everyone there. So circus people, come on. And I think that we have a tradition within the scriptures of a lot of fools and crazy things that happen. You know, we have like Moses that turns a staff into a snake. You know, you have Elijah that calls fire down on an altar. I like that. I like anything with fire. But you have someone hitting a rock and fire jumps out. Ezekiel eats a scroll. All of these really weird things. Hosea, for the love of everything, right? He marries a prostitute as this weird sign of God's love, even amid our unfaithfulness. Jeremiah walks around with a yoke on his back. All of these are sort of prophetic tricks, you know. They're stunts that make us rethink our life. And I like being a part of Greenbelt because there's a lot of fools here, you know. And the world, I think, needs more fools, especially when we start to begin to think that there's such a thing as a smart bomb. Then I think we need to rethink our holy foolishness. We need to consider what the scriptures mean when it says God chose the foolish things to shame the wise and the weak things to shame the strong. So I love the history of the church, and I just want to kind of remind us a few of those stories. And I'm sure that you may have some of those to share too. But one of the, I like the Franciscans a lot. And St. Francis was pretty nuts. A lot of you know that during the Crusades and during the period he lived in, he did all kinds of things like rip his clothes off and walk out of the town naked. But there was another Franciscan named Brother Juniper. And Brother Juniper was one of the great holy fools. And Brother Juniper, he was almost too crazy for Francis. And in fact, at one point, he was rebuked because he kept giving his clothes away to the poor. And he came out of this meeting with his superior, and a beggar asked him for his tunic. And he said, "You've caught me at a very bad time." He said, "I'm not allowed to give my tunic away again, but if you stole it from me, I wouldn't stop you." And I love that. And then there was another time where they, for some odd reason, they left Brother Juniper in charge of the cathedral and the altar. And some of the beggars came asking for money, and he gave them the things off of the altar, which is lovely. And the bishop wasn't excited about that, though. And the bishop came and just scolded him and yelled at him and got so angry that the story, the legend goes, that the bishop lost his voice yelling at Brother Juniper. And so Brother Juniper that night sort of felt bad, I think. And so he made a cup of porridge. And he took it to the bishop and knocked on his door and he said, "I noticed earlier that you lost your voice when you were yelling at me. So I wanted to make you some porridge." And the bishop was so angry, he just slammed the door, you know. And then he knocked again and he said, "Well, if you're not going to eat the porridge, could you hold my lantern so I can eat it because it's going to get cold?" And the way that the story ends is that they said that the bishop was so taken off guard and by this kind of hysterical thing that they just started laughing together and they hung out that night. And I think of the other stories, like that some of them don't end as well. But in the liturgy last month, we read the story of Brother Lawrence. Was it Brother Lawrence that they came during the one of the persecutions and they said, "Give us all of the riches of the church." And he brought out all the poor and the beggars. And he said, "These are the treasure of the church." And then they killed him. So, but those fools, those are the people that become some of the catalysts of our imagination. They become people that mix up the sort of normalcy that we find ourselves in. That's why I think it's great to be like walking along and seeing someone on stilts or seeing someone wearing whatever these things are that people wear, you know, whether they're camel skin or fairy wings. And so that sort of thing, I like it. And I think, but the place that it needs to happen is not just at Greenbelt, but that sort of thing needs to kind of rip open into the world so that we decorate the streets, you know, the stairs of Parliament with sidewalk chalk, and we go into the buses and the subways and the underground and we blow bubbles there, and we begin to, I hope, live in ways that are different from just the kind of pattern of normalcy. You know, I'm not sure how Christians became so normal, because I look at the scriptures and we follow people that are absolutely nuts. You know, that's why there are those people out there that say, "You know, my life was such a mess. I was sleeping around, drinking, partying, and then I met Jesus and everything came together." And I'm like, God bless you. You know, for me, I had everything together. I was going to go to college, get a degree. I was on this upward track of mobility, and then I met Jesus and it ruined me, you know? It messed me up. And I've been recovering from my conversion ever since. I sort of look at Jesus and he's never doing anything normal. Some people, if their friends left them on the shore, they might kind of swim out to the boat, or they might yell, "Hey, you know, come pick me up," or something. But Jesus just steps on the water and walks out. That's nuts. You know, that's a great little circus stunt. Anybody do that in here? You know, that they thought he was a ghost. It's crazy. You know, some folks, if they wanted to heal someone, they might lay hands on them, right? That's what a lot of us do. Or they might or anoint them with oil or something. Jesus wants to heal a blind guy. So he picks up dirt off the ground, spits in it, and wipes it on the guy's eyes. That's crazy. You know, I can't imagine any of the other rabbis going, "Rabbi, could you hack me up a holy loogie?" You know? You know, and I don't know if any of you went to my friend Kester's Dirty Theology. I thought he should have opened it up with that song, "Oh, talk dirty to me," you know. But he like talked about the theology of dirt. And what was beautiful is this image that Jesus is creating, taking the very things that we think are dirty and bringing them to life. He's taking dirt and spit and bringing them together and somehow bringing about redemption. That's why I love one of the things that happens on the cross. If you remember, as Jesus is dying, the veil of the temple is split open. And I love that image. It's that this veil that I studied it, and they said it was so thick, it was as thick as your hand, and it took dozens of people to even move the thing. It was huge, this veil, and it was ripped wide open. And I think it's that image that everything that had been held sacred in the temple is being set free into the world again. Not only is Jesus redeeming that which is broken and dirty, but Jesus is also setting free all of those beautiful things that the temple had the monopoly on. And I think that image I see in Jesus over and over, in the crazy things he did. He's always kind of shrewd with how he's dealing with those religious questions, isn't he? You know, when they come and they ask him those tough theological questions, I love it. He's always got like a really wild answer, you know, especially when it deals with something like money. And that, you know, they come up and they say, do you pay taxes? And he says, well, give to Caesar what's Caesar's. You know, that your coin, it's got Caesar's image on it, but Caesar has my image on it. I think that's sort of the subtlety of it. Dorothy Day, she said, once we've given to God what's God's, there's not much left for Caesar. And I think Jesus gets it that when the even more beautiful one is when they come up to Peter and they're like, Peter, does your master pay his taxes? And he says, do you remember that? Right. He says, go get a fish and it'll have a 4-drachma coin in its mouth. You guys ever had a fish with a 4-drachma coin in its mouth? I kind of look at that and I'm like, what is it that he's doing there? And I think he's making a spectacle of those deep questions that we seem to be asking. Well, do you pay your taxes? It's like then he ends up doing this beautiful sort of stunt with the fish where the money comes out of the fish's mouth. It's almost like a magic trick or something. And who cares about the money? A fish had a coin in its mouth. That's nuts. And Jesus is able to say, I made the fish, you know, and I love that. There was also a saying at the time that all of creation bowed in worship of the emperor. And there was even a saying that said, when the emperor walks by, the fish jump to lick his hand. So what must it have been to these hearers as they saw actually a fish jump to the hand of Jesus? And it's that sense that we can give the emperor what the emperor asks. We can give the empire what it asks, but not on its own terms. Because we ultimately have an allegiance that's much deeper than that. The peasants, there was a peasant saying that said, when the emperor comes by, the peasant bows and farts. I love the mischief of that, that it's that sort of thing that John Howard Yoder called revolutionary subordination, that we honor people, but we also know that beyond all of that, all of these deep things that we think we're doing, there is something that is more powerful and larger and more beautiful than those things. That's why, you know, the great expressions of that holy mischief, I think we can see in the Sermon on the Mount, too. Walter Wink, who unfortunately has been sick, but he points out so well that in each of those incidents in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is pointing us to a third way of dealing with these conflicts and these things that people try to trap us into. Either do we fight or do we flee, you know, and he's going, no, there's another way. So, say if someone is taking you to court to sue you for your coat, which a rich person could do to a poor person. Some of the landowners, if they had taken everything that they had from their servants, they could sue them for their very outer garment. He says, if they take you to court to sue you for your outer garment, take off your inner garment too. Strip naked in the court. I think that's beautiful. You know, it makes a whole lampoon of this thing. It exposes the greed that's there. And it doesn't make that just that person that's naked unpure, but it makes those looking on like that person that's trying to take their things. It's basically saying, you can have my clothes, but you can't take my dignity or my soul. So say one of the soldiers comes up because the soldiers, they moved by civilians carrying their packs. Say one of them comes up to you and they say, you know, carry my pack for a mile. It was Roman law that you had to carry their pack for a mile. So I'm sure there's a lot of zealots that are going, huh, you know, you carry your own pack. And Jesus says, no. If someone asks you to walk a mile with them, walk 2 miles. Grow to love them. Invite them into this kingdom that we're a part of. And you almost have this crazy thing where they couldn't ask you to walk 2 miles. So after a mile, the Roman soldier's like, okay, we've gone a mile. Give me my backpack back. No, let's go another mile. You know. And finally, that scene where and says, you know, if someone slapped you on your cheek, then turn to them the other cheek. And it's very specific that if someone hits you on your right cheek, turn to them your other cheek. And it's that sense that Walter Wink says it's very clear that you only hit with your right hand in the codes of the culture. And so the hit that they're talking about is not just a punch, but it's a back slap. It's the kind of slap a abusive husband gives his wife or a master gives their slave. It's the slap of a right hand to the cheek, and the maybe a typical response would be to cower down. But Jesus says, no. If someone hits you on your cheek, if they give you a back slap, turn and stare them in the face. Don't cower down, but look them in the eye and say, you can hit me on the other cheek, but you have to look me in the eye. You have to see my dignity and see that you are hitting the image of God. I think, what if that's the way that we had the courage and imagination to disarm violence? If we had the courage that I see in so many stories like that, that there was the story in the civil rights movement of this woman that was walking in a stroller with her two kids, and a white fella came up. She was African American. The white guy came up and he spit in her face to demean her. And she looked into his eyes and she said, and now, what about the two of them? What do you do with that, right? I think of those stories of people who have had that courage to look into the face of evil and say, I will still love you. I still believe that you are made in the image of God. And that has such power. One of the things that criminologists say, that someone who's creating violence, they can deal with someone who, and I kind of recognize this as a country bumpkin who's like moved to the inner city, that when people do something violent, they're ready for two responses. They're ready for you to fight back, or they're ready for you to run. But they're not ready for you to just stand there and talk to them, you know. And so there was this story of a woman who, someone broke into her home in the night, and she heard the window break. She's in her bedroom. Her kids are asleep, and she's a single mom. She's there. The person, she can hear them coming up the steps. She's thinking to herself, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And he comes up the steps and opens the door, and she said, I didn't have any time to think. My instinct just spoke, and she said, do you have the time? And the guy says, yeah, and he tells her the time, and then they start a human conversation together. And she says, look, you've broken my window. You've disturbed my kids. Like, what? You know, I got a lot to worry about. I'm going to work tomorrow. And she says, I tell you what, go downstairs and go to sleep. In the morning, I'll fix your breakfast and you get out of here. What do you do with that, right? This kind of crazy love that can still recognize someone's dignity. And, you know, that's what I felt in Iraq. Some of you know I was in Iraq with the Christian Peacemaker team and the Voices in the Wilderness. And I remember seeing over and over people who would look me in the eye and they would say, I know that you are not your government. And they would say, we know that we are brothers and sisters. And one of those stories was the story as we were coming out of Iraq. We had it was a treacherous journey through the desert, and we hit something in the road that spun our car off the road. It popped the tire, and we went into a ditch, and our car crashed there. And we were all injured in that car accident. And so we began kind of carrying people out of the car, and the first car of Iraqi civilians stopped. And they're waving a white sheet because the planes are flying over just as we were doing this. And two of my friends had head injuries, so their head's bleeding, and we're holding a cloth on their head. They pull us into their car, and they drive us into this town called Al-Rutba. We got in there, and it's a small town, just like 20,000 folks there. So it was big news, you know, the whole town starts getting together, and they drove us to the hospital, and they're walking with us. They take us to the hospital, and these doctors come out, and they say, Why, they're yelling. And we're like, good question, you know? And they said, why is your government? And they start naming off everything in their town that's been hit. And they said, and 3 days ago, a bomb hit our hospital. It hit the children's ward. And so we cannot take you there. And in the same breath, they said, but we will take care of you. Because here in Rukba, it doesn't matter if you're American or Iraqi or Christian or Muslim. We take care of you because we love you. And they set up this little shanty clinic with a bed for each one of us. And they began literally, for one of my friends who had gone into shock, they began to save his life. And finally, the other folks in our caravan had hunted us down and they came back and got us. We pulled all of our money together and we said, we want to give you this just as a sign of our gratitude. And those doctors looked and they said, no. Listen, we don't want your money. We want you to know that the only reason we care for you is because you are our brothers and sisters. And if you tell all of your people about what happened in Rukba, that's all we could ever ask. And we left as those doctors came out one by one and kissed each one of us on the forehead and offered their blessing. So that's sort of my last image of Iraq. And it's those sort of scandalous and almost mischievous things that I think can point us towards the imagination that can lead to something different than what we have now, that prophetic imagination that we hope for. That's why when people ask all these questions like, well, what do you do if someone comes in and they've got your grandmother with a gun to her forehead and they're getting ready to do terrible things to her, what are you going to do? I'm like, I don't, my grandmother's dead, you know? How do you answer that? I take off all my clothes and quack like a duck. I don't know, you know? Like, there's got to be something more creative than what you want me to answer that question with. There's got to be something else. One of my housemates, we're always kind of trying to think about how to disarm violence with creativity because we live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of violence. So whenever kids are fighting, my instinct whenever I hear a fight is let's go grab the torches and let's juggle fire on the corner. You know, because there's all these kids, like 30 kids are like, yeah, fight. Fire. Holy cow. You know, and they come down, they watch us fire breathe and juggle fire and turn backflips. And they're like, who wants to watch a fight when we got a circus, you know? And so that's the kind of imagination, I think, that if we can celebrate something different and not just say, kids, don't fight. But, hey, kids, there's something better. There's something more life-giving than that. One of my housemates, actually, that's been here, and a lot of you have met her, Amber, she's been in the community for 4 years, and she ended up going to Iraq with a group of folks called the Circus to Iraq. And they traveled through Iraq doing circus and theater with kids in displaced camps and refugees. And they would go from town to town. They would do skits on reconciliation. And they would juggle and play with kids. And I think that has so much hope, so much more hope than many of the other things that we're doing to try to bring about reconciliation and change. It's that kind of imagination I think we need. And finally, one of the folks that, you know, a few years ago, we started thinking, what can we have a kind of alternative celebration that celebrates another economy than the economy that seems to be built on the seven deadly sins? Can we celebrate the Jubilee? And we began to think, like, let's figure out what it means to celebrate that, because this was a command of God that would, you know, sort of dismantle the inequality that we create through the celebration of releasing slaves and redistributing land and forgiving debt. And, you know, folks say, well, the Jews never celebrated that. And one of my friends, Ched Myers, who's been here at Greenbelt, he said, well, we've never really done the Sermon on the Mount either, but that doesn't mean you throw it out. You know? So this Jubilee, can we begin to rethink what that means today? And we had someone that we were studying together about the Jubilee, and someone gave $10,000 that had been invested in stocks. And they said, we want to give that away to the poor because we believe that it wasn't our money but stolen money. And it belongs to folks that are workers and strugglers and people that are homeless. At the same time, we were fighting one of these anti-homeless laws in New York. So we won a big lawsuit and we had like $20,000. That's a lot of money for the Simple Way. And in fact, people are like, how do you do fundraising? I'm like, you get arrested every year, you know? And then you sue the city and you get $20,000, you know? No, it's not. I'm just, you know. That we had this money and we said, let's celebrate the Jubilee. And a lot of this belongs to the homeless. And where else should we have it but in New York City on Wall Street? So we started talking together and we were planning this with a lot of folks that were homeless and a lot of folks that weren't. And we gathered together and we decided that we would get all of the money in change so that we could really distribute it. And then we would get some paper money. But we got $1,000 in quarters, $1,000 in dimes, and $1,000 in nickels. I don't know if you've seen $1,000 in nickels, but it was a lot. It looked like we were robbing the bank. You know, we're walking out with all that money. And we load up the vehicles, and we go to New York with about 50 of us that are planning. And we got briefcases and backpacks, and we loaded up the money together. And we decided that just as the bell was opening on Wall Street, we would announce the Jubilee. And so we went in that morning, and we had gone through New York the day before, and we had told all the homeless folks to join us on Wall Street. And each flyer had a dollar attached to it, and it said, we're going to celebrate God's vision of Jubilee, where poverty can be ended. And we gathered that morning on Wall Street. We had said, you know, we're supposed to have kind of a ram's horn. Does anybody have one of those? And one of the old nuns, Sister Margaret, she said, I've got one. We said, bring it, you know. So she had her ram's horn, and we gathered on Wall Street that day. And we had folks that were stationed on top of the balcony with the paper money, and each dollar had the word love written on it. And as the bell was ringing, we read a statement that said, some of us here today have slept on Wall Street, and some of us here today have worked on Wall Street. But what we have in common is that we are all suffering deeply from the current inequality within our economy. Many of us are addicted to drugs. Many of us are addicted to money. But we recognize in each other our own brokenness, our need for God. And we believe that another world is possible, another world is necessary, and another world is already here. We call it the kingdom of God. And we celebrate that in the spirit of the Jewish Jubilee. And we blew the ram's horn. And then money started falling from the sky. It was beautiful. Folks started dumping their backpacks. And so the streets turned silver. And homeless folks were just dancing. We had sidewalk chalk that we decorated all over Wall Street. We dropped banners in front of the stock exchange that said, stop terrorism, share. And another one said, there's enough for everyone's need, but not enough for everyone's greed. And we gathered there and we danced on Wall Street. And people came out for the celebration. One guy, he called his wife and he's like, honey, you're not going to believe this. Money is falling from the sky. You know, another guy was coming by. He was a street sweeper. So he's sweeping the street and he flashes his dustpan and it's filled with money. And he goes, thank you. I needed that. You know, and so we celebrated that day, and it was contagious. You know, it wasn't just that we were there saying, locking down, you know, blocking the entrance of the stock exchange, saying, this isn't the answer, but we were saying, we think God wants more. We think God has something else in mind, and there was something magnetic about that. I hope that what rises out of a gathering like this is the sort of dancing revolution. As Emma Goldman said, if I can't dance, it's not my revolution. That we would have guerrilla peacemakers, but with a militant joy. That we would have people that are prophetic, but still laugh. That we can have folks that don't just protest, but protestify and prophesy. They lead us into new possibilities. And it takes that imagination. But I believe that that imagination comes from the Spirit. And I see it throughout the history of our church. And I see it throughout the life of Jesus. And I'm excited to see it incarnated here. So let's pray together. And I did leave time for questions. How about that? God of love, give us your imagination. make us fools in a world that, a world whose wisdom has shown itself so empty. Give us imagination to think of alternative economics and ways of sharing, ways of giving visibility to new possibilities. Give us the imagination to use things that were only seen as dirty, like spit and mud, to bring new vision and life. God, restore us. Restore us and redeem us as a people, that folks might look and see something peculiar and something different, because we are marked by your dream for this creation. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, we're going to have a microphone up here, and we have some time for dialogue. Since I didn't leave any time at all yesterday, I thought I would be a little more careful and leave some time. So you can come up and ask a question. You can come up and breathe fire. We might want to tell the fire. You can come up and juggle, whatever. But feel free to come and share.
Hey, Shane. I heard you on the Steve Brown radio show a few weeks back. It's an American, how do you describe it? Sort of a comedy show.
Yeah.
And the guy who runs it's like a conservative talk show. I only heard it once, so I don't really know much about him. But he was really impressed with you. And then afterwards he said that there must be lots of people behind him that are supporting his community, that are paying the bills, that are enabling you to live in the way that you want to live. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sort of reminiscent of the charge against Gandhi that he was poor, but there are a lot of rich people that are enabling him to be poor. And I'm wondering if you had any kind of comeback or answer to that kind of charge that he gave you.
Yeah, thanks. Well, first of all, you know, I think there is some sort of a facade that we are, you know, living homeless on the streets sometimes, or something, that we are like these wild, radical folks. And in a lot of ways, you know, I know how I'm going to eat every day. I have a home to sleep in when I go back, you know, and in some ways, I think that we've lost sort of the extreme radicals within our faith, so that the only reason that what we are doing looks radical is only an indictment on the sort of Christianity that we've become accustomed to. What we're doing looks very typical. It's kind of like what Mary and Martha did, you know? So I would say that in that sense, like, there are people that are crazy that are out there following Jesus in ways that would shame us. But a part of what was beautiful about the early church was that there was a deep partnership between what scholars would say, like, wandering charismatics and the local sympathizers that opened their homes up. But what I love was that people all had this idea that the church was about hospitality. And when Jesus sends the apostles out with nothing at all, you know, don't take any extra money, no clothes, food, or anything, it wasn't just so that they would go out and suffer in poverty, but so that they would be dependent on hospitality. And the church was put in a place where it wasn't just to practice hospitality, but it was dependent on it. You go into a town and people will welcome you into their home, or else just shake the dust off your feet and move on, you know? And so I love being in a place where I am the recipient of hospitality, and I'm thankful for people that open their homes up, not just to me, but hopefully to other people that are homeless or in need. A part of what I do when I travel and speak is I say to congregations, don't put me in a hotel. And the idea is that I want to stay with a family. And if you can't find a family in your congregation that's willing to take me in, we might not quite be ready to dialogue about community, you know. So I think that there is that. And I'm also not really judgmental, you know. And so I think it's fun to be on the Steve with Steve when we were able to talk and, like, laugh and dialogue. And I think that's one of the things that's changing, is that people are able to talk in ways that we don't just judge each other. You know, because I can see within Willow Creek, is a, you know, mega congregation in the state, States. I worked there for a year. I can see in that myself. I see my own complicity to this system. So we're all kind of entrenched in it. And I don't want to be marked by that kind of self-righteousness that you know, I hated in the conservative church. And now I say, thank you that I don't, that I'm not like those people that don't eat all organic, you know, or thank you that I'm not like those people that wear Nike, you know, or whatever. It's garbage. So it's not liberating. And so that's the, I think we need that sort of humility that just beats our chest and says, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. You know, I see within myself this giant log in my own eyes, so I'm not going to worry with the speck of the other yet, so. So come on up, and actually we might need to have a queue so that we can have as much time as possible.
When you had lots of money given to you, other people, other organizations would have built a big hostel, or they would have had a new structure, or they would have kept hold of the money in some way but used it for the poor, and I'd just like to know why you didn't. I think it's great that you didn't, but I'd like to know why.
Well, I think that a part of our, some of it's vocational too, is figuring out where we are. And a part of what I think the communities that are in our network within the States, what we can do is try to live as authentically with our feet on the ground as we possibly can and collaborate with tons of other groups. And so actually one of the other things that we did with the Jubilee celebration on Wall Street was we said, this isn't just about a one-time event, but this is about a movement, and this is about learning to live out Jubilee. So we sent $100 to 100 different groups that were living that out. And some of them are over here in the UK. Some are like Sojourners that Jim Wallace is a part of, and other folks, and trying to figure out how to create this harmony. So in my book, I do that as well. In the back, I list local revolutions and ordinary radicals, and we list about 100 of them that we say we're kind of in this together, and we want to connect the dots and give visibility to a movement. So that's part of what we get excited about. Yeah, and I also don't get too carried away with money. You know, one guy that, he was a venture capitalist that visited the community. I had him clean out a crack house. I was like, hey, you here for a day. You want to get your hands dirty, huh? So we went in and we, like, cleaned poop out of a house together. And he said, well, what would you do with, you know, $1 million? And I said, I think we would put it out there as broadly as possible to all the groups that are doing this kind of work, you know, and give it away as quickly as possible. So if you have $1 million, that's where it'll go. Just meet me up here.
Hi, I was just reading about the homemade clothes thing, and I was just wondering, is that an ethical statement? Or in here it says about that you make your own clothes. Homemade clothes.
Yeah. I didn't tell him to put that in there, but it is, you know, I think it is something that I actually, when I was in India, I lived in a leper colony while I was there, and I was so astounded by this vision of interdependence where they spun all their own clothes. They made their own bandages. And even when someone would have an arm or a leg amputated, they would make a new arm or leg out of wood for that person. So it was incredible. The name of the colony was Gandhiji Prem Nivas, Gandhi's New Life. And I love Gandhi's vision that we don't have to be dependent on the society that's oppressing us, but we can create a new society in the shell of the old. We'll march to the sea and get our own salt, you know. And so the homespun, the spinning wheel, was a central symbol for Gandhi, and I love it. I think it's great if some of our communities begin to be marked by making our own clothes, because we don't want to have clothes that are made by invisible people that we don't know, or by kids in sweatshops that we don't see, you know. So I think it's beautiful. I had a youth group that said, instead of going to Six Flags this year, we sewed clothes together. I'm like, yes, how about that for Youth Ministry 101? You know, so I think that's the kind of really beautiful things that we can be doing. So in one sense, it is a statement. And I think that that's the peculiarity of the kind of prophetic imagination. I'm not going to wear camel skin and eat locusts. But I think, like, if a lot of us started having peculiar clothing, it's a good thing that one of the marks of Gandhi's movement was even people in parliament and stuff started wearing the homespun, you know. And I think that seeing all of the bartering and the stuff that's homemade, that's the lamps that are made out of sardine cans, that's beautiful. And it has that sense of taking that which is a waste from this old society and bringing it to life and redeeming it. So I really like that. So I make mine out of scrap materials as well. So
you made those trousers?
Yeah, I make trousers. Yeah, I make clothes every winter with my mom. So, yeah. And if you need a good sewing teacher, my mom, she's up there. So, thanks. Yeah.
Hi. I'd just like to share with you all a story in response to the lady who asked the question about why didn't you build a hostel or whatever with the money. Shane has already mentioned Dorothy Day, who started the Catholic worker movement in New York in the 30s. And she was one of the inspirations for Shane's Simple Way community and also for the Catholic worker movement, which is still going on in the States and here in England, in Oxford and London. And apparently, somebody once gave Dorothy Day a diamond ring to help the poor. And Dorothy Day gave this diamond ring to a bag lady. And somebody asked her, why did you do that? Why didn't you sell it? Think of all the things you could have done with all that money. And she said, do you think God only made diamonds for the rich? And I think that's exactly the kind of stuff that Shane is talking about, the completely different response that we really need in this world.
That's brilliant. Thank you. That's great. Anybody else? You have one more chance here before we close. So, yeah, great.
Thanks very much, Shane, for everything you've said. It's inspiring stuff. I'm intrigued. Before you were messed up, as you put it, what was the trigger that got you from being upwardly mobile into what you now do?
Yeah. Well, I read the Bible. Right. Yeah. It's a dangerous book. I started reading the Bible and I just had I started reading these things and I'm like, my gosh, what if he meant that, you know? And I started surrounding myself by people who kind of dared me to imagine maybe he did mean it, you know? And that was amazing to me because I had only seen Christianity as something we believe, but not really as a way of living. So all of these questions about the peculiarness of our life because we're Christian, I had never really thought about it like that. And I had great teachers. You know, I learned from Tony Campolo and other folks that were really incredible at pouring into us in the States. But really it was Jesus that I fell in love with Jesus. And I read the things that he said, and I'm still figuring it out. I mean, I think people look at me and they think we've figured it out or something. And Lord have mercy, you know, we're just stumbling into it. But that's why, you know, this is a funny thing, because I got back from Iraq and this woman in the Bible Belt in Tennessee, I spoke about why I went to Iraq and I said, it's Jesus, you know, and she came up and she said, Jesus should be shaking his finger in your face saying, how dare you be so reckless with your life? How dare you put your mother through what you did? And my question is, which Jesus? You know, the Jesus who bid the disciples to come follow and like every one of them pretty much died. You know, I'm sure there were some angry parents, you know, and like this Jesus that dares us to, you know, if you want to find your life, then give up your life. And that sort of gospel is not a safe gospel. But my mother, she knew very well because she's been on this journey with me. My mom, I like my mom. You're going to catch that drift. You know, I'm her only kid and my dad died when I was young. So my mom will come up to Philly and she'll hang out with us, you know, and she's fairly wealthy, but she'll always take risks and go out with homeless people and go into abandoned houses and meet families. And my mom said to me, I used to always pray for your safety, but I've come to realize that I was praying for the wrong thing, because God never promises safety. But I pray that you will be with God, and there's no better place to be than that. And she said, and maybe the most dangerous place for a Christian is in safety and comfort and isolated from the suffering of our neighbor. And she said, so I just want you to be where God is. And if that's in Iraq, then I want you to go. And you have my blessing. And I've come to know that very well from being in Iraq and being in the inner city, is that when Jesus says, you know, we can fear those things which can do damage to our body, like bombs and knives and guns. He says, no, but don't fear those things. Fear those things which endanger our souls. And those are the subtle demons. Those are the demons of isolation and of putting ourselves in places where we don't encounter the poor and the suffering and the neighbors that make us uncomfortable. The danger of the suburbs, of moving and separating ourselves from all that look different from us. And living in a home with a gate that doesn't have any gays or minorities anywhere around. You know, those are the dangerous, the subtle demons. So when people ask me if I'm scared of the inner city, I say I'm more scared of the suburbs.
Hi, Shane. Day. Hello. You've talked a couple of times, like today and yesterday, about imagination. And this is my fourth Greenback year, and I love the vibrancy of it and everything. And I go away, and I guess maybe compared to some of the people around me, I'm slightly more vibrant maybe. But I just can't grasp that imagination, and I can't, like... I so want it, and I talk to my friends, and we've all been trying to do community, and we're quite kind of... dissatisfied with the church that we're part of. And it's like, what are your top five tips for taking the imagination from Greenbelt and injecting it into the rest of your life, for not just the next year, but the year after that and the year after that and throughout the rest of time?
Well, it's good. I think a part of it is surrounding yourself with people with imagination, you know, because imagination is sort of contagious. And you hear of different people's ideas that are out there, and you learn from each other, you know. And so part of what we did was we did a gathering this summer where we tried to just get people together that we saw with great imagination. So we had people teach workshops on how to convert a diesel engine to run off of used vegetable oil. We had people teach, my mom taught how to sew your own clothes, you know, and so like trying to figure out how to do that. And I think another thing just comes from really like sitting with the Spirit and thinking a very contemplative life, reading the scriptures and thinking together about that sort of imagination that only comes with the Spirit. Because it's not something instinctive that says, I'm going to love someone who's trying to destroy me. You've seen Les Mis, you know, where the priest comes and says, well, you forgot the candlesticks, you know, and comes after. Like, it's not my instinct when someone stole the power drill from our house to be like, you forgot the drill bits, you know? No, you know, like, that's crazy. But I think it's only from incarnating the fruits of the Spirit and thinking on those things, kindness, gentleness, goodness. Like, I have some beads that I will think on those fruits of the Spirit, and I'll hold one and I'll think of goodness. I'll hold one and I'll think of kindness, and I'll try to think of these things that are so contrary to so many things within the world. And that's just another thought. But I think, you know, some of that comes too from, as we fall deeper and deeper in love with Jesus, I see within him such imagination as he's confronting power and he's confronting terror. And the cross is the most beautiful. You talk about a stunt, you know. The Colossians says that on the cross he took all of the power of this world and disarmed it and exposed it for what it was. He took this dirty symbol and he triumphed over it. And I say the resurrection's the best circus stunt there ever was. It's that beautiful image of love wins. But I also think that one thing that you say that's so important is that we're not just being weird. We're not just being freaks so that we get attention for ourselves. You know, it's easy to have some of that here too, or to have that in our neighborhoods where you just like, you're just weird for the sake of being weird, or you're weird and people think that you're the coolest thing in the world, you know? But I think that we're only strange because we've fallen in love with a God that's strange, and in love with a kingdom that's in opposition to the patterns of this world. And so we're only freaks in the way that it brings glory to Jesus. And so that's probably a good way to end. Thanks for your question and your humility. Let me close with the words of those early freaks. This is from Corinthians. Boy, what a bunch that we have to follow. This is 1 Corinthians 4. It seems to me that God has put us apostles on display at the end of the procession, like people condemned to die in an arena. We've been made a spectacle to the whole universe, to angels as well as to people. We are fools for Christ. But you are so wise. You are honored, but we are dishonored. To this very hour, we go hungry and thirsty. We are brutally treated. We are in rags. We are homeless. Up to this moment, we have become the scum of the earth and the refuse of the world. That's the followers of Jesus. The scum of the earth and the refuse of the world. I pray that that we will have the courage to follow. As Dorothy Day said, I read the things that Jesus said, and I look at our world, and I can't help but ask, have we even begun to be Christians? And I am so excited to be among people here that are going, let us begin. Let us begin to be Christian again. Amen.